welcome all of you to the first meeting of the Gonzaga Socratic Club for, I'm trying to make sure our technical stuff is working right. The first meeting of the Gonzaga Socratic Club for spring 2008. The Gonzaga Socratic Club is an organization that exists to philosophically inquire into and reflect on issues relating to the Christian worldview, and we treat a wide variety of topics. We had a talk in the fall on Catholic identity in the university, such as Gonzaga, and I did a talk in December on C.S. Lewis's Voyage of the Dawn Treader, if you're into C.S. Lewis. The club takes its inspiration from C.S. Lewis and his presiding over the Oxford Socratic Club, which existed at Oxford for a number of years while he was president, and was well known as a lively gathering place for Christians, atheists, agnostics, and people of all stripes who are interested in thinking and talking about Christian worldview questions. Today we're going to be talking about the teaching as a pastoral vocation and the teacher's pastoral role. This is something of great interest to faculty at Gonzaga who are Christians. One of the questions that we ask is, what place does that pastoral role play in our carrying out the educational project? And I know it's a particular matter of concern to our two speakers today. Dr. Brian Clayton is a professor of philosophy and is well known around campus for his classes on C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. He has other interests in political philosophy and philosophy of human nature, among other things. Father Tim Clancy is, I wanted to check this, but I wasn't sure. Are you the youngest Jesuit on campus now?
No longer.
Okay. There's somebody else has come and usurped your position.
Yeah.
But Father Clancy is one of the youngest, or perhaps the second youngest, Jesuit on campus. And both of these, Father Clancy is the director of the Honors Program, also a colleague of mine in the philosophy department. And both of these colleagues of mine are very interested in this question of the pastoral role that a teacher can and should take in the classroom. So what they're going to do is something rather unusual for the Socratic Club. We usually have a speaker and a response, but I understand they're going to do something like a tag team presentation. So the baton will be passed a time or two, and then they may ask each other a few questions, but then we'll have time for discussion after that. So let's welcome our speakers. Thank you again for coming.
Thanks, David. I wanted to say something about the source of this joint presentation. Last summer, Father Tim was kind enough to invite me over for a lunch at Jesuit House, and we had a wonderful conversation. And we got to talking about the courses that we teach and the approaches that we take. And as we talked, I realized there's an awful lot of commonality in how we view teaching and how we view relating to our students. And so Dr. Calhoun had asked me some time ago about talking about this particular topic, and I thought, well, it might be more interesting to have a couple of us kind of talk about it, because we wind up taking things in different directions, even though we have very similar, I think, starting points. So thanks for the lunch again. This is not intended to be mimicking Father Spitzer, but I've got three questions. The first question is, what is meant by pastoral vocation? The second question is, why ought I to think of teaching as a pastoral vocation? And the third question is, what does this look like in practice, or what difference does it make if you look at courses and so forth? And I'm going to talk about the first two and then turn things over to Father Tim, and he'll, I think, address basically all that material and the three questions, and then I'll add my 2 cents worth here at the end. Then we'll have a conversation. So the first question is, what is meant by pastoral vocation? And in good philosophical style, I want to try to define the terms here. By pastoral, we're referring to spiritual care or guidance. Now, it might seem odd for me to be here talking about this because Father Tim is the only ordained pastor of the two of us. I am a subdeacon. Does that count?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Oh, okay. So that counts.
I didn't. On the clergy side of the divide.
Okay, I'm on the clergy side. Yeah. That explains a lot of things. Anyway. I'm a subdeacon in the Antiochian Orthodox Church. But it seems to me that even quite apart from that, the notion of spiritual care, of pastoral care, is one that extends beyond just the clergy. Certainly parents are concerned, or good parents are expected to be concerned, good Christian parents are expected to be concerned with the spiritual care and guidance of their children. And in that way, they assume a pastoral role with respect to their children. So I see the notion of pastoral care as something that applies more widely than simply, obviously, to clergy. The term vocation is well known to us. It refers to a calling, and especially to a vocation that's undertaken in response to a calling. So that in speaking of a pastoral vocation, teaching is a pastoral vocation, there is at work here a notion that we are called as teachers, those of us who are Christians, and that's the audience that I'm primarily addressing here. We're called as Christians to be spiritual caretakers and guides for, in some sense, those who are in our classroom as teachers. That's our particular duty. So, the second question is, well, why ought I to think of teaching as a pastoral vocation? Again, it seems to me that all Christians are called to care for others. All Christians are called to assume some sort of vocation, pastoral care, of course, is just one of those vocations. But why think of teaching in particular as a pastoral vocation? And in homage to our ancestor, St. Louis, I don't know who we refer to, St. Jack. St. Jack. I thought I'd quote from The Weight of Glory, the final paragraph of this. This was a sermon that he preached in 1941. He says, "It may be possible for each to think too much of his own potential glory hereafter. It is hardly possible for him to think too often or too deeply about that of his neighbor. The load or weight or burden of my neighbor's glory should be laid on my back, a load so heavy that only humility can carry it, and the backs of the proud will be broken. It is a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses. To remember that the dullest and most uninteresting person you talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship, or else a horror and a corruption such as you now meet, if at all, only in nightmare. All day long we are, in some degree, helping each other to one or other of these destinations. It is in the light of these overwhelming possibilities, it is with the awe and the circumspection proper to them, that we should conduct all our dealings with one another, all friendships, all loves, all play, all politics. There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are mortal, and their life is to ours as the life of a gnat. But it is immortals whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit. Immortal horrors are everlasting splendors. This does not mean that we are to be perpetually solemn. We must play. But our merriment must be of that kind, and it is in fact the merriest kind, which exists between people who have from the outset taken each other seriously. No flippancy, no superiority, no presumption. And our charity must be a real and costly love, with deep feeling for the sins, in spite of which we love the sinner, no mere tolerance or indulgence which parodies love as flippancy parodies merriment. Next to the Blessed Sacrament itself, your neighbor is the holiest object presented to your senses. The idea that Lewis expresses there, several of the ideas. First of all, that everyone that we meet, of course, is a potential god or goddess, to use his language, and that in our interactions with people, we are helping people move either towards God or away from God. Well, that applies generally, but then, of course, as a teacher, it applies to me in my vocation as a teacher. And it seems to me, then, that I have a special concern as a teacher to assist students to move towards God and not away from God. Now, I'm not saying I'm very successful at that, but that's how I would understand what I'm trying to do as a teacher in my pastoral capacity. Excuse me, my mouth's really dry from cold medicine. So. Okay. Now, this has certain implications in the context of being a philosophy teacher. Teachers in other areas are more competent than I to say how this works out for them, and other philosophy teachers are more competent or competent to say how they see this working out for themselves. But this is how I see it working out. First of all, to think of philosophy itself is not a discipline. Instead, philosophy is a way of life. That it is the pursuit of wisdom. It's the love of wisdom, the pursuit of wisdom, the love of truth, the pursuit of truth. And if, as the saying goes, all truth is God's truth, then that's both a comfort, it seems to me, and a challenge. Because what I want to do as a teacher then is to encourage my students to move towards the truth as well as I can. The truth that, for example, in a human nature course, the truth about what human beings are like, for example. Or in ethics, the truths that are relevant to living well, living a flourishing or a full human life. So the love of wisdom then it implies not just, though, the love of truth and the pursuit of truth, of course, but also knowing how to live. It also involves praxis or practice. How much, you know, we control we have over that, teachers, I suspect, come to realize pretty quickly that we have very little control over our students' actions. But we can at least model, and we can attempt to set up the learning environment in such a way that students are able to move towards truth. I'd also appeal to an idea, I mentioned this in my human nature course typically, from Tom Morris, the philosopher who's now retired at a very young age. Richard could say how much he makes per lecture to IBM executives nowadays.
$30,000 for the first hour.
There we go. But he used to tell his students that philosophy helps you to think carefully and deeply about the most important things in your life. And it seems to me that that's exactly right. The idea of thinking carefully, of course, is that we don't want to jump to conclusions. We want to make sure that we've considered possibilities, objections, and so forth. The idea of thinking deeply is we don't want to stick with just sort of the surface impressions, but instead realize that there's a depth to the issues that we confront. So our first impressions about, say, an ethical issue, or our first impressions about what to say about characteristics of what a human being is, those first impressions may turn out to be mistaken, and we need to be pressed to see the depths, the deeper questions that lie below the surface. And again, as a philosopher, I think that this is important for me to try to do in the classroom. In addition to that, I'm borrowing some notions from Walker Percy, that Percy thinks of us, and he's borrowing off of a tradition as well, that eventually goes back to St. Thomas, but he thinks of us as sovereign wayfarers. Now, it's possible, of course, for us to lose our way, and it's also possible for us to sell our sovereignty. But what he has in mind is the idea that we are on our way in this life. And the educational process, taking philosophy courses, taking literature courses, business courses, engineering, whatever, that's part of the whole process. The sovereignty aspect for Percy is taking responsibility for what's going on, not simply being content to sit back and just sort of feed me, right? Tell me what I've got to know for the exam, for example. But instead to take responsibility for learning. I'm to be an agent. I'm to be active. And so insofar as I can encourage my students to be sovereign wayfarers, which I think is an accurate description of the human condition, then I'm moving them closer to the truth, and I'm helping them to live in accordance with the truth. This also means that, and I think this connects back to the Lewis quote, it means that it's in the little things that we do and we say and we think every day, the little activities, that we can share God's love with others, that we can have an impact on others. A personal story that when I first came to Gonzaga, for the first several years, I was really frustrated because you have to go through this evaluation process. And the evaluation committee, nobody in my department get upset here, but the evaluation committee, different people on the committee were giving me contradictory advice about what to do, right? And finally, I just got so frustrated, I said, the heck with it, right? What am I doing here? And the real turning point for me in terms of being at peace with what I was doing and feeling some confidence about where I was headed actually came over a summer when I decided, look, I can't be working to please, X, Y, and Z, right? If this really is a vocation, then I need to think about this as I'm actually working for God, right? So, how do I pursue that calling? And then we'll let the chips fall where they may, okay? At least in terms of my own spiritual and mental life, that was a huge relief when I could just sort of think of it in those terms. Let me end there, and let you pick up from there, and then we can come back and I can talk about what this looks like in particular course settings.
So. Well, that's a great place to segue because I'd like to start with a similar crisis and how that helped me think of my teaching in a more pastoral way. I'm a Jesuit priest. Why has my provincial missioned me to teach philosophy at a university? I mean, we have Jesuit universities, but why do we have Jesuit universities? Why are we devoting all of this manpower and all of this energy into higher education? And specifically for me as a priest, how is this a form of priestly ministry? A lot of people, a lot of priests, right, when they ask, what does it mean to be a priest? The assumption is you're going to come up with something that nobody else can do, right? That, well, you're a priest because then you can do this that nobody else can do. Or the essence of being a priest is doing this that nobody else can do. It's kind of coming out of Aristotle's, you define by giving the specific difference, and I've always said, and I like to say, that what the essence of being a priest isn't something that priests do that nobody else can do, Or you can do that about Gonzaga University. The essence of a Jesuit university isn't that Jesuit university isn't what's different about Jesuit universities from all other universities. So with regard to me, it isn't what's different. It's
it's the way in which we do what we do, that we approach it as a spiritual task, we approach it as an apostolic task. Now, I was trained to teach young Jesuits philosophy as part of their training to the priesthood, and it was obvious to me that philosophy was important in training future priests, because I think priests need to have a critical understanding of their tradition, and they need to be able to understand where people are coming from, and to be able to understand a lot of different ways of understanding so that they can be pastorally effective. So it was pretty clear how this was priestly ministry to me when I was training priests. Right? But when SMI, which was the, we had this institute here at Gonzaga that was training future Jesuit priests. Well, that got closed. In fact, it got closed the year after I finished my training to run that place. So,
bureaucratic effectiveness.
Yeah. Well, that created a crisis. It created a crisis of what the hell am I doing here? And should I be here? Right? How is being a teacher of regular students, how is that priestly? Right? What's ministerial about that? Right? And until I could answer that question, I was miserable and confused and disoriented. And the answer to that question came through my work as pastor of a parish, because it occurred to me that I could pastor students the way I pastor parishioners, and that that would make it very meaningful, even if these guys aren't going to become priests. Right? So the first step for me in how I see teaching as pastoral is concern for the student as a whole person and not simply as a student in the classroom. And that cashes out in the conviction that taking my class is not the most important thing they're doing and shouldn't be their highest priority. Getting the homework on time shouldn't be their highest priority. That there's other things they're doing that could be more important than being in my class on a particular day. Right? In other words, that I should hope that they have their priorities straight. And I would hope that getting an A in 201 isn't their highest priority. Right? That doesn't mean I give everybody A's, but it does mean that I understand when people can't be there. I understand when people turn in papers late. I have a very flexible, in fact, it doesn't really serve well people who need deadlines. And it also involves a recognition that people may be struggling with issues at any particular time that are far more demanding of their attention than studying for my class. They may be dealing with, you know, everything from depression to anorexia to crazy home life to being dumped by their boyfriend or their girlfriend. That there's all kinds of other things going on in their lives that that might call for giving them a little space, a little break. So that was the first thing, is to treat my students as I would treat parishioners, which is basically with compassion, I guess, you know, rather than high standards, they meet the standard, or they don't. Another way this comes in is, what do I want, is what kind of an experience do I want them to have in the classroom? And I love playing with opposites and paradoxes, so bear with me. I think it helps things to stick when you say it in a paradoxical way.
So for example, I hope students walk away from my class knowing less than they thought they did when they started the class. Right? I want them, because I assume everybody walks into human nature thinking they know what it means to be a human being. They've been one. And that this is a really stupid question. Right? So I hope they walk away knowing less than they think they know when they enter, but actually, of course, knowing more about just how little we really do know and how much more complex and rich and thick and ambiguous and conflicted the issues are that they walked in thinking they knew the answers to already. I also hope they walk out understanding themselves better. And it's my conviction that to understand oneself, you have to understand other people. And it's in understanding other people, understanding other ways of understanding things, that one begins to get a critical distance on one's own understanding. Once you realize that not everybody thinks it's obvious, right, that abortion is murder, it makes you realize that it isn't obvious to you, that you've got a reason for saying this other than, well, it's just obvious. Right? So it forces you to understand yourself better, I think, by trying to understand other people who think very differently than you. And so my classes are all about trying to understand some very different ways of understanding the material and then evaluating those different understandings in light of whether, you know, what you think are their strengths and what you think are their weaknesses. And I always insist that students do both. You know, I don't just want to hear how they agree with something, and I don't just want to hear how they disagree with something. I want them to be able to do both on everything. Because they should have a sense of what the weaknesses in their own views are, as well as the strengths. Which doesn't mean you change your view. It's just that you have a recognition that you're going to have a fairly weak understanding of these kinds of issues, given where you're coming from. And so, you know, maybe you need help there, or even just the recognition that, you know, I'm not going to be real insightful talking with anorexics. You know, their personality, my personality, totally different. I'm going to have a hard time understanding where they're coming from, you know, or a two-year-old or whatever. I think it's important to understand that in understanding oneself, part of that is understanding what you're good at understanding and understanding what you're not so good at understanding. And to understand how other people understand things, not just how they understand it, but why they would ever understand it that way. So to understand why, say, Descartes' strong division between body and soul, why that would ever be, why anybody would think that's plausible. Right? So understanding what are the questions that this is an answer to, and what are the context in which that answer seems like an adequate way of addressing that question, right? And there again, it helps, I think, ultimately to reflect on, well, how does my context, how do my questions affect what I think is the answer? I hate outcomes language. I think it's based on a fundamental mistake. But anyway, what's the outcome that I hope for from students taking my class 5 or 10 years later? You know, what do I want, what effect or what vestige from my class would I hope there to be, you know, 10 years out from taking my class?
because I'm very ambitious. I don't want to affect somebody for like 4 months. I want to affect somebody for a lifetime. So what kind of things am I hoping for way down the road? What kind of things, and of course what I want to affect is, I mean, what I want to ask then is, how does what I teach affect the shape and the direction of their character? How is this going to affect them as a person? How is it going to have, what kind of effect is it going to have on their character? What kind of effect is it going to have on their understanding of what their calling is, right? The direction that their life is going to take? And first of all, it strikes me that it's going to be as much a matter of how I treat people as what I teach them. Right? So that gets back to the first point, you know. I'm hoping that I'm modeling character traits that I hope other people kind of pick up by osmosis, you know. And then the second big issue is, I don't think they're going to remember the content of what I've taught them, you know. We had a discussion on this on the listserv, and we had even people with doctorates in philosophy claiming that after their BA, they didn't necessarily remember what Descartes said, you know, which I thought was rather staggering. But you know, I mean, this guy teaches Descartes now, but it wasn't because he remembered what he was taught, you know, junior year of college. So I don't think it's the content, really, that people are going to remember 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, 30 years down the road. I think it's going to be more the questions. At least that's my hope. That the questions don't stop when they leave the class. That hopefully I'm focusing on questions that are central enough and vital enough and relevant enough that this is just the beginning of a pursuit of that question. That hopefully I'm awakening questions or giving people more resources for thinking about questions that they've already been thinking about. But the last thing I want, or the horror scenario for me, is that somebody walks out of my class, burns their notes, and says, thank God I never have to read another philosophy book for the rest of my life. You know, kind of like what you might do after your last calculus class, right? That's what I don't want to have happen. So I want my class to address questions that are vital. In other words, live questions, not academic questions. Questions that I think they should be asking. Questions that I think it's really important for people to think about. Questions that are going to make a difference for how you lead your life and what you value and don't value in life. Questions that are going to shape your character. Questions whose answers are going to shape your character. And that are going to help in the understanding of what one is called to do. And the first step being to see the meaning of one's life, the purpose of one's life, less as a choice than as a calling, than as a response, rather than simply, I think I'm going to do this with my life. I could have done 5 other things, but I'm going to do this. It's like, first of all, seeking to understand oneself and then responding to that understanding with, you know, where, who am I, you know, who am I, you know, and how do I become that? So in the end, it's teaching philosophy not as a body of knowledge, but as the pursuit of wisdom. I mean, which gets us back to the beginning, right? And that makes philosophy very different from some other fields. But that's the way I approach philosophy. Now, how does that cash out in, this is the second part of the presentation, that Brian will respond to after I talk about it. How does this cash out in human nature and ethics, in how we teach core philosophy classes? So when I started planning for how I was going to teach a human nature class way back in 1981 as a soon-to-be regent at Gonzaga University and asking myself, you know, what am I going to do with this class? And I started by asking, what are the questions that I would want somebody who's only going to have studied two or three philosophy classes in their whole lives, what questions do I want to see them asking? That I've only got this opportunity. What's the most important thing to ask? And what are the most important answers for them to be exposed to? In my human nature class, I start with a quote from Virginia Woolf, that the truth is to be had by lying together many varieties of error. This idea of reality being kind of a palimpsest of perspectives and dimensions, each of which has its core applications, whether insightful and helpful, and then there are more peripheral applications where they start getting to be rather forced and less plausible and less helpful. And in terms of like what answers I wanted students to be exposed to, I asked, what answers are they going to be exposed to anyway? So it was like I wanted my students to be exposed to the views that I thought they were most likely to encounter in their subsequent academic life and in their subsequent life. Those are the views I want to have a chance to think through with them. So I came up with four perspectives on human nature that I thought most everybody is going to run up against and be exposed to in one manner, shape, or form. And they were psychoanalysis, sociobiology, existentialism, and romanticism. And over time, I was able to boil that down to what I now think are four basic orientations to reality. I mean, this has gotten very cosmic, right? But I have this kind of fourfold hermeneutic where I think there are four basic ways of approaching reality, understanding reality, and they happen to cash out on those, in contemporary terms, in those four theories, which is really interesting. And I get those four orientations from how we conjugate verbs. And I don't think that's a coincidence. So there's an objective orientation. Two of these are more objective, two of these are more subjective. You got an objective orientation where it's a logical, deductive approach. You got a model, you deduce conclusions. And Freudian psychoanalysis very much fits into that. You've got a third-person approach, which is kind of the scientific inductive approach, where you take the position of a disinterested, impartial observer. You try very hard not to put your own values, your own thoughts into the data, right? You're trying not to contaminate the data. And then you've got a first-person approach, which is very expressivist, where you see everything in terms of your desires, your purposes, your goals, existentialism. And then you've got a second person or relational approach, dialogical approach, which I think is the heart of romanticism. So you got first person, second person, third person, and impersonal approaches to life. And then I take those approaches through psychoanalysis, sociobiology, existentialism, and romanticism, to some very important questions, like what's the meaning of life?
maturational questions that these people are going to face. You know, how do I want to raise my kids? What's love about? These kinds of questions that fit nicely with these different theories, actually. And then the questions of spirituality, the nature of value. I don't really get into aesthetics too much, but you could. So that's kind of how I approach human nature. The idea being that I want people to have a critical exposure, I sometimes think of it as an inoculation, right? Where you give people a little bit of the disease so that they can build up antibodies, right? So inoculate them with the contemporary views that they're going to be confronting in their lives, and to have them assess what are the strengths, what are the weaknesses of this view, what do I think about it, you know, where am I on these different approaches, how do I approach the world, that kind of stuff. In ethics, it's very similar. It's ended up being very similar. If I begin human nature by saying the truth is had by lying together many varieties of error, that life is ambiguous, I start ethics by telling them that in most classes you are taught skills such that at the end of the class it's easier to do these things. Whereas in ethics, I would hope that at the end of the class you will find deliberating on ethical issues a lot harder, because you'll realize how much more complicated they are, how much more you have to take into account, how many more factors you have to think about in evaluating something. And again, I just look at the basic approaches out there. Ethics that's focused on intention, you know, that it's the person's intention that decides the morality of the act, so can't. And then approaches that look at consequences, and it's the consequences that decide the evaluation of the act. So there I look at utilitarianism. People who look at the agent as what's important, you know, so focus on, you know, what makes for a meaningful life, or how am I being true to myself? So existentialism again. And then again, a relational approach where it's all about how do I be true to this relationship in this decision? Right. So I introduce those four approaches and take them through some questions that I think a lot of people face in this world today, questions like torture, abortion, gay marriage, world hunger, how we treat animals when we eat them. And then I end the class with a couple weeks looking at contemporary technology, which is happening right now under their feet, and where they're the experts, looking at technology that has only existed in their lifetimes, and asking, how is that changing relationships? You know, what kind of relationships are easier? What kind of relationships are harder? How is it changing identity? How is it changing the consequences of our actions? So basically getting them to reflect on how is my use of cell phones affecting my moral world? How is my use, how is my multitasking affecting my identity? Right. How is my involvement in Second Life or in chat rooms or on video games? How does that affect me as a person? What kind of relationships can I have on Second Life or in a chat room? How does it affect how I think about relationships? What I expect from relationships? How does it affect what I think are the obligations that I have in relationships? So that's how I end it. But I hope both of these classes are very much focused on how to live my life. And so that they're not that theoretical in that sense.
Okay.
I don't have a nice segue. But.
Okay.
Well, let me start. I'm just going to make some brief remarks. One is that, given what I said before, drawing from Lewis and Walker Percy and so forth, I want to be honest with my students. It's especially important, I think, in both the human nature class and the ethics class. Not that I'm dishonest with them, and when I teach critical thinking, that's not the point. But honest about where I am on certain positions or issues or whatever. I'm up front with them. Not that I expect them to adopt my particular position, but so that they know where I'm, how I'm thinking about this and why I'm thinking the way that I'm thinking. And so one of the things that's important for me to make clear in the classroom is actually that I'm a Christian. And so it's frequent practice in my classroom to begin with prayer or with a verse of scripture or something like that, which about the only place that I encountered that in my education was when I took a contract law class when I was in law school at Notre Dame. And Professor Murphy began every class meeting with a prayer. And it occurred to me one day, well, gee, I could do that. This is a Catholic university, it's not a state university. So it's kind of, I guess, flying the colors. It's okay, which also means that it's okay for students to introduce their religious beliefs, whether they believe God does exist, God doesn't exist, whatever it is they believe about God, whatever the specific content of the religious beliefs and commitments. That needs to be able to be brought into the philosophical conversation, because I'm dealing with the whole person. Right, I'm not just dealing with one little segment. I want them to be engaged as the people that they are in thinking about, reflecting on the matters that we're addressing in human nature, that we're addressing in ethics. It also means, for me, that this pastoral vocation also means that I've got to, I really have to be willing to be humble. Because as a teacher, I mean, you're in a position of power with respect to the students, right? And it's very easy, or can be very easy, at least it is for me, to get provoked and respond in a way that doesn't respect the fact that I'm dealing with an immortal being here. And I'll give you an example. Last semester in a C.S. Lewis class, I don't remember all the details, but a student kind of went out of her way, in my perception anyway, to say something in, let's say, an aggressive manner, and I responded sharply at the time, and then I was bothered by it, but I wasn't quite sure, what to do about it. But I wound up going back to that student and apologizing to her and asking her to forgive me for that, because I hadn't respected who she was and where she was in terms of her own life. And I mean, maybe this is a general rule for, I mean, maybe all philosophy teachers do this, maybe they don't. But the way I understand it, my orientation towards this was to see this as actually flowing from my vocation as a Christian specifically. So those were the terms in which I was, and it wasn't anything horrible that I said to her, it was just the kind of the tone, I think, that I thought was, on reflection, just too edgy. So that would be an example. And being willing to admit, I don't know, when they ask me a question. I'm not the expert on everything. Being willing to be humble enough to say, I don't know, let's check this out. Viewing myself in the classroom as part of the learning process, because I've learned quite a bit from my students. In my notes for ethics today, I look back at my notes from last year, and I had jotted down what one of my students said because he had a brilliant way of putting a particular point. And I asked him if I could steal it from him, and he kindly gave me permission. But those are the kinds of things, right, that I have to be willing to, I need to accept from my students, and so I find that I learn a great deal from them. I've already mentioned that I want to have space in the classroom for their all of their worldview, which includes their religious beliefs, to come into play. That's all legitimate as far as I'm concerned. But then when I look at particular classes, and I'll keep this very brief, my question is always, what's the audience? It makes a big difference. If I'm teaching a course that's filled with philosophy majors who are thinking about going on to grad school, then I have a certain responsibility to them, right? If I'm dealing with a general student population for whom this is fulfilling a core requirement, or maybe they're taking a minor in philosophy just because they've gotten interested in it, but they're not going to go on to grad school and be expected to have, you know, sort of a mastery of the history of philosophy or something, or of the current state of play and philosophy of mind. Just pick a random example. For the student in the classroom, what does that student need? Given this audience, what's most helpful? So, for example, in human nature, this is something that Dr. Calhoun and I have worked out over a number of years. We've constructed the human nature course as a kind of narrative, the point of which is to understand competing views of what it is to be a human being that they're going to encounter here, but also to see where these things started from. So we start with the ancient Greeks, but it's not just sort of, well, first this person said this, and then this person said this, and then this person said this. It's intended to be a narrative. It's intended to be a story, and we've labeled this the loss of the soul. With the turn in Descartes, in the second meditation, the soul disappears, and in the modern world, then we start talking about the mind. Okay, well, what does that lead to? And so we kind of trace up into the 20th century. And so where are they going to encounter these things today? What might we think about as possible responses to where we are now? These are things that it seems to me to be useful to students. In ethics, I don't do a survey of theories. I do 2 days at the end that I call ethical literacy, where I say, here's what Kant said and here's what John Stuart Mill said. Right, here's utilitarianism, here's deontology. Most of the students that I have, the big moral issues in their lives are those everyday ones. How do I get along with my roommate? Right? How should I understand this particular relationship? What kind of job should I be pursuing? Is this morally appropriate for me to be pursuing a particular line of work? What kinds of questions ought I to raise about it? Again, those are the kinds of things that I want students to think about. And the way that I wind up approaching that is primarily through Aristotle, and then stories, through true stories, novel, you know, fiction, and through lots of movies as well. Because in story, we see these characters, right? We see these ideas actually embodied, and we begin to see some of what it means to live out these things. But again, the overarching idea is, what do they need, or what do I have to offer anyway, you know, out of my resources, that might be useful to them, with this understanding that, again, I'm not dealing with just sort of preparing citizens for, you know, to be productive, right, in the vast machinery of the American economy, but instead I'm dealing with people who are immortal beings, and who are on the way. And I want to do what I can, to use another image from Percy, to hand them along and to be handed along by them in turn. So.
Well, one of the things you said that responded with me a lot is the idea of teaching as an ascetic practice. I think it is an ascetic practice. I think early on, my teaching was more about performance and about showing off. But the older I get, the more ascetical the practice becomes. Because it's really about them thinking. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes means me keeping my mouth shut, even though I think I know how to better say what they're doing than they do. But they got to think it through. They got to make the mistakes. I can't protect them from the mistakes. So it is really an ascetic practice, I think. And it might take them 10 years to even recognize that, you know, I guess I did learn something from that class. I remember when I team teach, I remember sometimes I walk out of a class. This was mostly when I team teach American Christianity or American Catholicism, walking out and turning to the person and saying, but I think I've done it in technology too, walking out and saying, you know, they have no idea how good that lecture was. They have no idea. They're not going to get this anywhere else. But too bad. They weren't clapping at the end of class. And I also agree with you. I mean, what you said about the ethics also reminded me of something that's very, very important to me and has really shaped my way of teaching ethics, which is I really don't think people have a hard time figuring out what to do. I think the hard thing is having the motivation to do it. And so that most of my ethics class is about what motivates people. Why is really the question of why be ethical, which I was talking about in my own training, taking a meta-ethical class where we read Frankena, who's an analytic ethical person, and his last chapter of his book on ethics was why be ethical, and the answer basically was, well, if you want to talk ethics, you gotta play the game. I mean, but if you don't want to play the game, then there's nothing I can say to you, right? If you don't want to be ethical, there's nothing I can tell you, right? And I thought that was like the worst possible or the thinnest possible motivation to be ethical is, well, yeah, if you don't want to play, don't play. You know, that there's got to be more reason, there's got to be more value to being ethical than because I want to be ethical. So that got me really into, okay, you know, it's because I am who I am. It's because of how I want my relationships. It's, you know, to try to tie it to identity and less in terms of universal norms, more in terms of identity.
Should we open this up?
We better.
Yeah.
So questions, comments? Anybody want to do just a discussion a little farther?
Yeah, I guess I have two questions. I wonder to what extent you see the success of this pastoral vocation, the student to understand what you're doing. Like, do they need to know what you're doing in order for that to work? As you were saying, I mean, when you're actually a pastor, the parishioners know what's going on. Right, they're coming there in a sense, they know. But I wonder to what extent you see that. Does the student have to understand what's going on?
The pastoral motivation?
Yeah, and just how you're working your class. Because it's apparently different than what other people might be doing. So, does that make sense? That's question one. And then I wonder if you see a tension between the grading system and your vocation. As a teacher, trying to be pastoral and yet having to give grades. Is there a tension in that?
Well, let me take the second one. I don't see a tension in that because something that's very important to learn in life is that you're going to be evaluated on your performance, whether you're a good person or a bad person. And just because you work hard at something doesn't mean you're good at it. So, you know, I'm very understanding. I recognize this is not the most important thing in people's lives. And, you know, people can hand papers in late. It doesn't bother me. But doesn't mean you're going to get an A. Right? I'm evaluating you on what you did. And I can talk with you about whether you should be so upset at how poorly you did. You know, saying, well, maybe this isn't the most important thing in your life. You know? But I do think it's an injustice to students to not evaluate them, not evaluate them objectively. Now that said, I also think that that core classes should be graded leniently. I don't think people should be, I don't think that we need to be hard asses in classes that they're taking basically for their own personal enrichment, right? So I don't think, you know, you ought to be giving everybody C's. But I do think you need to differentiate recognition. Some people do better than others.
Yeah, I think, let me address the grading thing too. For me, what I try to do is to make very clear up front what the expectations are. Now, that said, if you've got a problem, all I ask is that you come and talk with me about it, let me know, you know.
Right.
If you died the night before, I can understand why you didn't do your just let me know. Given that they know what the expectations are ahead of time, but also recognizing this isn't the most important thing in their life, I like that way of putting it. There's a fair amount of flexibility, but in the end, I'm not doing a person a favor by saying, "Oh, you wrote this wonderful paper," when I know, well, it's really lousy grammar all the way through, right? Poor word choice. This is unclear. It's muddled. That's not helping the person, and therefore it's not being pastoral. And so, what I want to try to do, and how effective I am at doing this is another matter. But what I want to try to do is to assist the person to see, okay, here's what the problem is, okay, and then how can we address it? And so typically, in classes where I have essay assignments, I will allow rewrites. Because, there isn't much point in sort of giving the feedback if then they don't have a chance to do something in response to the feedback. And so I try to focus in, okay, there's a particular problem, let's try to work on this and see if we can't solve this, by the end of the semester.
Another thing I do that I think of in this line is I try to give more positive than negative comments on papers. So I'll just throw in, good thought, nice insight, well put, and try to have more of those than no, that doesn't work, and stuff like that. So that they do get kind of, I didn't think it was a terrible paper, I just didn't think it was an A paper, right? And then explain why they got the grade they did. But I do think it's important to give positive feedback as well as negative feedback on papers. Again, recognizing that these are people, not just horses trying to get over bars.
Yeah. And your first question is whether students need to know about the pastoral approach. I don't know. I'm not sure why.
See, I
think, why would that be important?
I guess my question is there, whether if they understand what they're doing there, because you're trying to get them to see something differently. And maybe my question is just how explicit are you? Do you say, look, what you guys are being shaped in with particular kinds of people? That's an explicit way of saying.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say that.
On.
I wouldn't say that. Because that would give the impression that I want to shape them a particular way. And even if I do, it would ruin it if they did it because I wanted them to do it, right? So
I guess I'm not saying so specifically, just that's going on. Like, something's going on here, and what you're doing is identifying it to the students.
Yeah.
You know what's going on, or what you think you're trying to do. They need to know.
Yeah, I like being more a snake in the grass. I like it. I like them to gradually come to the realization, And like, for example, I don't tell people where I stand. And I try really hard to be a ventriloquist. That if I got something I want to say, I find a philosopher to say it for me, and put him in the sequence, right? So I really want kids to not know where I stand. And maybe because it comes from my background as a priest. People take priests way too seriously. And I feel I've got way more. I don't want my authority to be kind of getting in the way of their thinking for themselves. Now, maybe I've just got too grandiose a sense of my own importance. But historically, people ask priests what to think, And so I try very hard. I really enjoy it when people don't know what I think.
Protestants don't do that.
They protest, yes.
Well, in the human nature course that David and I have developed, and we tell them up front, we're telling you a story. There are other ways to talk about this, and this is a particular way.
Oh, I would do that.
Yeah, this is a particular way of understanding it, and here's why we're doing it this way. And we do that in the online course, and we do it. I do it anyway in my regular semester classes as well. And in ethics, it's kind of important for me to give them an idea up front of why we're doing what we're doing, because they're going to talk with friends in other ethics courses. And in a lot of those other ethics courses, it's going to look much different than what they're doing. Mm. So I feel like I need to let them know, here's what I'm doing, here's why I'm doing it. And I am trying to get you to think about what counts as a good human life, and what kinds of virtues and vices you need to be aware of, and so forth. But then,
well, you've got such a non-standard course, I think that makes a lot of sense to say, here's why it's non-standard.
Yeah.
I think I was going to kind of jump off his question slightly, and I also had a second question. I think part of what he was asking, if I'm not mistaken, especially when he made the comparison of, well, if you're a pastor of a parish, do people know what they're coming for, is that if your goal is to... if you have a definite worldview, a Christian worldview, and you see it as part of your vocation to help people to be better people, and presumably help them to be better Christians, that means that you are, as a in a pastoral role, you are trying to direct them in a certain direction. I think the question was, is it ethical to do so without being upfront with them? Because the people who go to a church, they're going there saying, with the willing expectation that they're going to be drawn into, say, Christianity, presumably. But the question, I think part of the question is, is being upfront with the student that your ultimate, you aren't going to grade them based on what they believe, and you're going to be fair, but part of why you're doing what you're doing is to try to help them to be better persons. That's what makes it pastoral. And your conception of what better persons is a Christian conception. And so, I guess part of the question is it fair to pursue that endeavor without them realizing that they're the sheep of your pastoral action?
Right.
And then my second question was, if you feel that that this pastoral role is something that's somewhat of a duty or somewhat of a vocation, because you are a Christian and a teacher, as a Christian institution, Gonzaga University, doesn't that likewise give every professor in this university a similar obligation, at least to some degree, because they're working within the context of a Catholic institution? And part of that question is I've been in numerous classes where I may have had, some sort of minister as a professor, even for a religious studies course, who say straight out, well, if you were to come to me in the church, I would be concerned with whether or not you were living a Christian life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But because this is a scholastic enterprise, I'm going to teach in a very different way, and I'm not at all concerned with, your spiritual state. And to me, that seemed like a contradiction. As a Catholic institution, the very reason the religious studies course is required in the first place is that, in my thinking, is that the university wants to be able to present the gospel, not to require that people accept it, but why else are they requiring religious studies courses other than to make sure that the gospel is presented? So those are the two questions.
Okay. Let me say, I won't touch that second question with a 10-foot pole.
Okay. I'll touch it.
I'll let you touch it in a minute. With respect to the first question, at least for me, that's why I try to be upfront about, okay, here's where I am. You don't have to buy what I think. You're entitled. The way I put it, you've been in my classes, you know what this is like. I say when you walk through the doorway, you have a set of beliefs, you have a worldview already, okay? And that worldview, from my perspective, is innocent until proven guilty, which just means that What we're engaged in doing in the philosophy classroom is working on that worldview, to, you know, our beliefs about what exists, the nature of that which exists, what the good is, etc. You're entitled, right, to start with wherever you are, and what we want to do is to have a discussion about that. Now, in order for us to have a discussion about that, I think it's important for me, anyway, to let you know, here's where I am. But you don't have to agree with me. All you have to do is to agree to engage with me. You can challenge my beliefs, you know. I can challenge in a friendly manner yours. You know, why would you say that? That kind of thing. So that's my answer to the first question.
I have a comment about that.
Okay.
Okay. And no one will be surprised about this that knows me, but as someone who loves Kierkegaard, there is a method of engaging your audience, which is, in his mind, I think, preferred, that you sort of disappear as you kind of talk about, you try to do. So that the student, in the case of a Christian, you know, like a Christian dialogue, the speaker is not the representative of Christ, but that the audience would have an experience directly with Christ, and that the person in the middle doesn't get in the way. So I'm not necessarily saying that that's a way to justify the religious studies that part of the question, but I've been fantasizing about teaching for probably 20 years, so one of these days maybe I'll do it. But I think I might take a balanced approach between the two, because the real goal is to try to get that intentionality within the student, that agency active, and if it's better in some cases to disappear, then I think you should. And if it's, you know, I mean, this is
more to play the devil's advocate. Yeah, I mean, I was going to appeal to Socrates, but Kierkegaard's just as good. I mean, Socrates doesn't play fair either. He pretends not to understand when he understands totally well. And he says, oh, my God, I don't know if we've gotten anywhere. And then the student is supposed to say, oh, no, we've done this, we've done this, we've done this. You know, but, yeah, you're supposed to, yeah. So I guess I'm an ironic teacher in that respect. But I try to draw the student out by disappearing. That's part of what the ascetical quality of teaching is letting the students work it out for themselves and just being a spur to that. With regard to the other question, I think there's a big, I mean, being both a preacher and a teacher, I think they're very different things. And I would never preach, or to the extent that I preach in the classroom, I don't think I'd be a very good teacher. And to the extent that I teach in a homily, I think I'm a lousy homilist.
Because I think the goal of preaching is to articulate the spirit alive in the community. I should not be telling my parishioners things they don't already know. Right? I'm articulating that. I'm articulating the common belief of the community in bringing the gospel to bear on that. And it's not the time to be introducing him to the historical critical method. It's not the time to be arguing Christological debates. It's not the time to be giving proofs for the existence of God. Right? That's not the job of preaching, in my view. Now, that is the job of the classroom. And I do teach religion. I teach American Catholicism, now American Christianity. That's part of the beauty of the honors program, is you can do a lot of interdisciplinary stuff. You got a team teach it to do it, but you can still do it. And there, I would say it's, I don't know, I am concerned about the spiritual well-being in my students, and that's precisely why I want them to be engaged in critical theological reflection. I want their theological, I want their piety to be exposed to rational self-criticism, because I'm convinced that only then will it mature. So, and I think that's what religious studies is trying to do, is it's trying to mature people's religious piety through engagement in critical inquiry. So, I mean, that's the way I would look at it. But my job isn't to mature my congregation's faith. It's to be a locus where it kind of comes to expression.
Dave?
Two questions. First of all,
nobody has two.
There's two people.
Well, no, but they could have three or one. Anyway.
Would it be fair to say that every teacher is selling something, and to the extent that it's the notion that I'm just a sort of I'm a neutral dispenser, I'm the post office that just brings you stuff. I don't, you know, I'm not responsible for the content of it. In fact, you know, whether you teach math, at least if you're good at it, whether you teach math or philosophy or Shakespeare, you're selling some aspect of your subject matter. And I would agree with the idea that therefore you ought to be as candid as you can be about what it is you're selling, so that students aren't misled. Second question I have is whether or not, if this sort of follows up on your question, is if teaching is a pastoral vocation, then it's a pastoral vocation for every teacher, not just in every Catholic university, but it's a pastoral vocation for every teacher. So it's not something to either choose, geez, some of us take it as a pastoral vocation, some of us do not. The point would be that some of us do that job, and some of us apparently don't understand that that's our job and don't do it. But anyone who says, well, that's not my job, is to be a pastor, well, they're wrong about that.
But, those are mine. Well, it's interesting. We had, on that second point, we had a lively discussion on the listserv in the fall in the philosophy department. And it all started with, I don't know who started it, but it all started with this idea of what do we think we're doing in the classroom? Given these studies that 10 years out, people don't remember a thing they were taught, you know, unless they're actually using it in the past 10 years. And this distinction between philosophy as a way of life and philosophy as a body of knowledge, and am I teaching a way of life or am I teaching a body of knowledge? And we've got a pretty diverse department. I think we're pretty celebrated for being a diverse, fractious department. And yet everybody agreed that they're teaching a way of life. There wasn't anybody who thought they were teaching a body of knowledge and who didn't see their teaching as in what I would call pastoral terms. Now, not everybody recognizes everybody else's teaching as pastoral, but they recognize it, they see it themselves as a pastoral vocation. So I'm not sure there's that much disagreement about that, at least in the philosophy department. I mean, maybe there is in the physics department. But I'd be shocked if there was that kind of diversity in the religious studies department. The second thing is, I hate the metaphor of selling for teaching, just that. I don't think students are consumers. I don't think we're selling things, but we are professing things. I remember Tom Rukavina, now retired but still alive, kind of a ghost that haunts the philosophy department. When he would interview people for jobs, he would ask, okay, you want to be a professor. What do you profess? You know, and we do, it is a profession. I mean, we do profess things. There are things that are important. And it's important that we know what's important. But I don't think, so there are things that I profess. There are things I want to have done, but I don't see myself as selling those things. I just don't like the metaphor.
If I could relate David's question back to the Lewis quote from The Way of Glory, Lewis is essentially saying that, well, he's challenging us in our relationship with other people to realize that we're either moving them toward God or away from God. If that's the case, then I think another way to put David's point would be, well, everyone, whether they realize it or not, is pastoral. The question is whether that is a beneficent or an internal pastoral work that they're doing.
That's fair enough, yeah.
And of course, well, in our non-judgmental context, very few people would be willing to say what you're doing is actually driving people away from God. I mean, very few people are going to say that. But I wonder about this. I want to take one particular aspect. I mean, maybe you want to reflect on that. That's one thing to think about. Since everybody has 2 points, I at least have that. The other thing is, I would agree, Tim, with what you said about philosophy being a way of life, but increasingly, it's clear that students need content to reflect against their own thinking and reflecting about what a way of life is. And if I think about the Lewis quote in that light, it means that sometimes we can't avoid, I'll use the dirty word, paternalism. We can't avoid this authority structure that's built into teaching because we want to say, you need to see that these two beliefs you have are inconsistent with one another. Or you need to realize that the belief that you're expressing on this particular point is a very poor account of what there are superior versions of available. What do you make of that problem, either of you?
Well, I do think you need to engage your students by disagreeing with them. I mean, that's a genuine form of engagement in a classroom to say, you know, why do you think that's what Descartes thought? You know, or that's not what Plato said, and stuff like that. But there's an ascetical element in there too, I think you need to give students enough space to think for themselves. So it's a balance. I know we all have to negotiate this. It's like, okay, we want them to improve their self-understanding. We want them to think, we want them to realize they don't know as much as they think they know. But we don't want to just make them think that they're idiots, right? You know, we don't want to mop the floor with them, right? So there is that judgment call all the time. You know, am I going to challenge this or am I going to let this go? And how strongly am I going to challenge it? You know, I think that's why part of why teaching's an art is there is no rules for how you engage students in a way that's beneficent rather than infernal. I like that metaphor a lot.
Let me. I just want to add one thing, and I guess this goes back to David's point again, or the first one. I think one of the reasons for me that it's important in many of my classes, not in all of them, but to make clear where I am. I mean, critical thinking, you know. But human nature and ethics and, you know, the Lewis class and the Percy class, you know, just be upfront about stuff. That is my sister went to a state university, and by this time I was, I would have been a junior or senior in college. And so she took a philosophy class because she wanted to see what Big Brother was up to, right? You know, why would you ever be interested in this? You know, she's going to be an accountant. And the professor apparently saw it as his obligation to disabuse her of all her religious beliefs. Okay, I didn't make clear, right, that this is what the agenda was. But every time any kind of religious belief, you know, reared its ugly head from his perspective, the mode of dealing with it was to attack, right? And if I recall correctly, I mean, she said that he eventually came out and just said, right, my goal, now here, truth in advertising, my goal is, midway through the class, of course, my goal is to have you all walk out of here not believing. Well, it would have helped her, I think, if she had known that on the first day of class, that here's what this guy's trying to do. Here's what his position is. She may not have taken the class, for one thing, or at least she would have been, then I know what to expect. And so, for me, part of the motivation, I think, comes from my sister's experience. That, you know, it was an abuse of his position as a teacher. And maybe I've overreacted and, you know, but going in the other direction. But
Yeah, to me, that's an example of not giving the students room to think for themselves.
Maybe one last question, Dr. Creech.
Well, okay. Joel left, unfortunately. I didn't... it seemed to me that his question was a little bit different. That is to say, he was suggesting that maybe if the students were clearer about the pastoral approach from the beginning, they'd be in a better position to take advantage of it. I'm not sure that that's what he meant. But I think that's what he should have. In other words, I put the problem this way. I mean, the student goes to accounting class and the instructor distributes a syllabus and says, you know, we're to read this and we'll have an exam about that, so learn the material or learn this skill, so forth. Okay, when the student reads accounting and walks into the core course, the instructor distributes a syllabus and says, we're going to read this. And then there will be quizzes or exams or papers and so on and so forth. The student might be very well along in the course before he or she realized that no, we're supposed to be doing something different in here than we were in that other course, and might have wasted lost opportunities that those might have been missed now because the student wasn't open to that. I'll just relate it to one other thing. When I was doing a lot of this work with the core curriculum, one of the outside people came and I was talking with him about this, and you know, he asked how popular core courses were with students or how they viewed them. And I indicated, well, I think they're probably not very popular. And he said that wasn't because we were teaching them badly or anything like that, but he looked at what we were doing and said, you know, you don't tell the students ahead of time what it is that they're to expect. The core curriculum, you don't use it enough in recruiting, you don't tell the parents what this is about, you don't tell, even some of your teachers probably don't understand that it's different and what's unique about it. And that was his advice. The best thing to do is to make clear to the students that there's going to be this whole other way of viewing it. And I thought that's what Joel was trying to get at. It works better if the students know that this is going to be different when they walk into the course.
I'm not sure that's true, but I can understand that that's a possibility. I mean, I walk in, something I didn't say about core classes, and I've only been talking core. I think when you're talking people going on to doctoral degrees, you got to give more content. But I do, one of the things I do is I just assume nobody wants to be in here when I walk into a core class, and that my job from the beginning is to motivate them to learn, which means you got to raise the questions before you teach the answers. Right? They got to know what these are answers to. So part of it is I think you got to seduce the kids into the education.
But
I don't think you can tell them ahead of time and then they're going to say, oh yeah, that's what I want to do.
Well, I suppose we disagree about that.
Yeah.
I think that...
Because they think they know it all. They already think they know it.
Since I am up front with my students, my experience has been that students do approach me after class, outside of class, to talk about these kinds of things because they know where I am and that I'll be sympathetic, critically sympathetic. In that respect, I think there is an advantage to them knowing that there is this opportunity. Okay, well, if you are a believer and you want to really think through these things and so forth, then I'm a sympathetic person to speak with, you know, and I'm interested in the same thing.
And if people weren't calling me Father Clancy, I might feel the need to be a little more upfront. I don't know. But I'm too worried that they already think they know what I think because I'm a father. Right. So I try to hide.
Well, we try to finish on time. Thank you very much. Let's thank our speakers again. Please. feel welcome to stick around and informally continue the conversation. We hope to see you next month at the Socratic Club. Thanks again.
Thanks.
We're getting wonderful pictures of Italy.
We are, yeah.
I've been looking at these for the last.
I just want to know that it's a white line.
Yeah, it's still working.
Sufficiently shown, not enough to not take the class.